William. William and Annetta are waiting in Marion Dunlop's small study on a blue sofa, flanked by boxes of tissues, flimsy white flowers stirred gently by the small wind coming in the top of the window, not knowing, as usual, what to talk about. Small talk seems ridiculous. Big talk equally to be avoided. What's the point, after all, when they're paying someone else to talk about all that with them? And so, as if in agreement, they sit in silence. Marion Dunlop arrives, with two glasses of water, which she puts down next to the tissues. She's a young woman, much younger than William. She has little glasses and a tightly wound bun, like a librarian in a film. Maybe the glasses and bun are an attempt to compensate for her bird-boned slenderness, her lack of visible pores, the reediness of her voice. William tries not to think of her as a whippersnapper, or to wonder aloud what a girl her age knows about marriage or life or death. It's a test of his prejudices. He needs to make an effort to pass.
So, Marion Dunlop says.
She's asked them to call her Marion, but she'll always be, in William's mind, Marion Dunlop.
In our last session, Annetta was explaining that she felt she lacked insight into how William has been feeling, which is where I'd like to pick up today. Annetta, did you mean William's feelings concerning the issues in your relationship, your living separately, or the PTSD symptoms, or something else?
Anything, Annetta says. Everything. When it comes to William, I have literally no insight into anything at all.
Well, Marion says, that's quite a broad scope. William, are there any general feelings you'd like to share, having heard that?
Nothing springs to mind, says William.
Okay. Maybe it would be helpful to start small when it comes to feelings, says Marion. Why don't you tell me about your morning, maybe? How did you feel this morning?
William thinks about his morning, which could be any morning. All William's mornings are the same. His alarm goes off at 7 so he can start work, his new job as a gardener, at 8. He gets up, goes to the bathroom, brushes his teeth with the toothbrush kept in the ceramic pot with a picture of a smiling frog on it, shaves with the electric razor in its own corner of the mirrored cupboard, his corner, even though the rest of the cupboard is empty. He dresses, goes downstairs. He puts Radio 4 on and listens to the news, or as much of it as he can. Bombings, shootings, stabbings. He turns the radio off. He eats his breakfast in silence.
I felt fine, he says.
So you don't usually experience any flashbacks or episodes in the morning?
Marion Dunlop asks.
No,
William says.
Sometimes.
Okay, says Marion Dunlop. And how do these episodes usually...
I already filled in your questionnaire, William interrupts. It's all on there. Do we have to go over it again?
Marion Dunlop pauses. Then she says, we don't have to go over anything if you don't want to.
Okay, he says. He's ashamed of himself for snapping at her. Sorry.
Wait, Annetta says. I didn't know about a questionnaire. We can look at it now, if William feels comfortable with that,
Marion Dunlop says.
It might be an easier way for him to share his experiences. William?
William nods.
Marion Dunlop picks up the folder next to her. She takes out a piece of paper.
Here we are, she says. Number 1. I persistently avoid discussing or thinking about the traumatic event. Williams ticked that one.
No shit, says Annetta. Ugh, excuse my language.
Number two, I have full or partial amnesia of the event. William hasn't ticked that one. Number three, I experience intrusive, recurrent recollections and flashbacks. That's ticked. Number four, I experience feelings of distress or intense physical reactions when reminded of the event, e.g. sweating, pounding heart, nausea. William has ticked all of these.
Oh, says Annetta.
She takes a breath, lets it out through a thin gap in her lips. The sound of it fills the silence. How do you feel, hearing that?
Marion Dunlop asks her.
That I can't believe I have to hear it read out like that, says Annetta. This is what I mean. Communication. It's like I'm always trying to get William to speak, and he just won't. But how can anything be fixed if he can't open up?
She looks desperately at Marion Dunlop, like she's willing her to get out some sort of trepanning equipment, a hammer or saw, and physically force William open. Marion Dunlop doesn't oblige. She leaves her usual pause, then says,
And how do you feel, William, about what Annetta's saying?
They both turn to look at him. William knows Annetta's right about him. In the box on one of the homework sheets Marion Dunlop had given them early on, the one that said, communication, he'd have liked to write, no thank you.
I'm sorry, he says to Annetta. I don't need you to apologize, Annetta says. I want you to talk. I want to understand.
She turns to Marion. It's like talking to a brick wall, a wall that just keeps saying sorry. There is a short silence.
You're frustrated, observes Marion Dunlop.
He didn't even tell me why he left the police force, Annetta says. It took me months before I got even a clue. All I know is a few scraps. I don't even understand why that case caused all this. But then he never talked about any of his cases, the upsetting ones. He never talks about his childhood, like how his dad died when he was really young. And now he's got PTSD, and he doesn't want to talk about that either. He just wants to skip it and get a memory wipe.
Would you like to talk about the death of your dad, William?
Marion Dunlop says.
I don't think we've touched on that before.
Because it's not relevant, William says. I've only had these symptoms in the last few years, so that can be ruled out as a factor.
The chief inspector has spoken, Annetta says. Case closed.
Marion Dunlop says to William,
It seems like something you'd rather not discuss.
There's just no point, says William. He knows he sounds curt and that he can't apologize for his curtness now either.
Okay,
Marion says.
And I take it you'd still like to get a memory deletion.
William can feel Annetta looking at him. He doesn't want to look at her in case there are tears in her eyes. Yes, he says. I do.
And you've spoken to your GP? Did they give you the information booklets, paperwork, and so on?
Yes.
Okay, Marion says. Okay. It's probably good that you have time before the next session to read the Nepenthe material and have a think. Then we can talk about it next week.
Thank you, Annetta says to Marion Dunlop. Her voice is tight. William knows that this thank you really means thanks for nothing. He thinks Marion Dunlop probably knows that too. William knows Annetta wants to understand. The problem is that he doesn't understand. He doesn't know how to explain it to her. It's a feeling. He knows that. But it's not classifiable. He has no name for it. He definitely doesn't know where it came from. It's like a shadow passing over him. Vague. Too big to see how big it is. But big. The shadow arrives. That's the only way he can describe it. The shadow arrives, and everything under it looks different. William reads Nepenthe's prospective client advisory material over breakfast. A bowl of slightly soft cereal, a brand once loved, then abandoned by the kids. It's a glossy, heavy brochure, like something you'd pick up in an expensive shop. William wonders if these things are actually displayed anywhere to tempt potential clients. Where does human regret live? Police stations? Hospitals? Courtrooms? Hotel bedrooms? Bedrooms in general. They should advertise on pillowcases. It's not only the flashbacks and anxiety, says the leaflet. A traumatic memory can impact on your own sense of your personal life story. Over time, it begins to skew your perception of the world. Our PTSD clients often describe their traumatic memories as swelling, distorting, or taking over other parts of their lives. Which sounds about right. The prospect of the memory shrinking, his life expanding to its usual size, is almost unbelievable. An escape, a reprieve. He wants it so badly that it's too painful to think about. It's Sunday afternoon, and Fiona, William's daughter, wants to go to the park.
"All my friends are there," she says.
She's managed to invest the words with considerable urgency. The way she fixes him with her expectant gaze reminds him of her mother. Like Annetta, Fiona is stiff and quiet with new people, which sometimes leads them to assume that she is a meek or placid character. As with Annetta, this is not the case.
"All your friends?" says William. "So is Jack going to be there?"
At age 11, Fiona has a pretty decent poker face. She got that from William. She assumes it now.
"Jack is one of my friends, so yes."
"Your mother says that Jack's your boyfriend," William says.
William doesn't actually care about Jack. Now that it's been established by Annetta that Jack isn't some 23-year-old from the internet, but another kid in Fiona's class with a set of train track braces and a pet dog he himself named Pickles, William is relaxed about Jack. In truth, William's playing for time. He's feeling edgy. He needs to work out whether the edginess is reasonable.
"Oh, so you're comparing notes on me now," says Fiona with disgust.
"Something like that, yes."
"Okay, whatever. Can I go?"
William smiles blandly. He wants to say no. The no is so near to his closed teeth. A pressure. No. He keeps it back, tries again to think. William knows it's hard for Fiona and Milo. He used to be a background figure in their lives, a permanent, ignorable presence. But now, time with Dad has become an end in itself. It's artificial. No child should have to go on dates with their dad, for God's sake. Plus, he doesn't stand up very well under the increased scrutiny. He has the kids one night a week and every Sunday. The problem with Sundays is becoming apparent. It's late summer. Fiona has a boyfriend, and he's at the park with Fiona's friends. Correction, all her friends.
"Well," he says, "do you have your phone?"
She nods vigorously. William sighs.
So I can go?
She asks.
Where's Fiona going?
Asks Milo, coming downstairs. To the park.
Oh, can I go to the park too? Dad, no, please, no. He'll try to embarrass me. Please, don't make me take him.
He'll try to embarrass you. Surely that's not true. I can see how it might happen by accident, but it's not fair to infer intent.
He told everyone my poem,
Fiona says flatly. Milo looks immediately abashed.
What poem? Says William.
A poem I wrote. He found it and he learned it off by heart, and then last week at the park, in front of everybody, he started reciting it.
Milo has gone red.
I didn't mean to.
You didn't mean to recite a poem, William says. Unlike Fiona, whose composition is so clearly 50% William, 50% Annetta, Milo's nature is mysterious. For example, William has no idea where he got his love of performing. Milo's good at it too. His King Herod, both magisterial and sympathetic, stole the show from Mary and Joseph at last year's nativity play.
I didn't mean to embarrass her, Milo cries.
It turns out that Milo had been allowed to hang out with Fiona and her friends just once on a strictly trial basis. Fiona had watched him suspiciously, but her friends had been nice to him. Milo wanted to offer something in return. He also wanted to show that he had been entrusted with this, a beautiful poem, his safe passage to the world of the big children. Of course, he didn't phrase it like this. It was all broken up because he was trying not to cry, but William got the gist.
Okay, William says, cutting them off. How about Milo promises not to recite any more poems, and Fiona accepts that he meant well.
Fiona's looking hostile.
And I'll let her go to the park this afternoon alone for a couple of hours.
Yes, agreed.
Fiona says quickly.
And Milo, William adds, before his son's dropped open mouth can form a wail, we'll walk Fiona to the park, then we'll go to the cafe next door. I can keep an eye on your sister, and you can have a sundae.
The wheel of fortune turns. Whoops from Milo. Fiona looks stricken.
Can't I have a sundae, Dad?
Of course. But, sweetheart, you don't have time for a sundae and the park. I've got to sort dinner out, then take you guys back to your mum for 7.
How casually he says it.
Huh,
Fiona says, drifting towards the stairs to put on her shoes.
Invisible thought bubbles float from her head. Then she turns and, miraculously, says,
I think I'll have the sundae, if that's okay.
William nods. Careful not to celebrate too conspicuously, celebrating inside, within his ribcage, which has expanded with the joy of not having to spend the afternoon stifling fears of his only daughter being injured or mugged or abducted or murdered. We live in Malting, he tells himself, a tiny, quiet outpost of the quiet village of Hassocks. He knows for a fact there's been no abduction, rape, or murder in Malting since 1980. That's why they moved there, for God's sake. Malting hasn't changed. Something has gone wrong with William, that's all. At the cafe, Fiona has a Knickerbocker Glory and Milo a double chocolate cherry cream sundae with extra sprinkles. It's dinner time in 2 hours. William isn't sure whether this is good parenting, but what the hell? Milo and Fiona are talking animatedly about some teacher they both hate, and the sun's coming in through the window and warming the side of his cheek like someone's put a hand there, and he's still got 4 hours before the car journey to Annetta's mum's house. And there, the thought is in his head. The car journey to Annetta's mum's house. William tries, and usually manages, to live in the moment. Not for any healthy, happy reason, more because the past and the future are often too much to think about. Take this thought, for instance. Break it into its components. Car journey. A half hour of limbo, broken up chatter, heavy contemplative silences, occasionally tears, a tumour feeling in William's stomach. Annetta. Wondering if Annetta will come to the door. When she does, it's painful. When she doesn't, it's painful. He isn't sure which he hopes for. Mum. Judy. She came to the UK from Jamaica when she was a child. She now suffers from arthritis and has lived alone since the death of her husband George. She was half grateful when Annetta came to live with her, half angry. Throughout the separation, she'd unashamedly sided with William. He didn't even have a side, for Christ's sake. He knew he'd shut Annetta out, he'd made it impossible for her, but Judy managed to find one. She told her daughter she expected too much. She was ungrateful. She should be happy to have a man who worked every day and fed his family. And generally pissed Annetta, a maths lecturer, off so much that Annetta frequently forgot her intention not to get drawn in and would argue with her. Then Judy would cry. House. William worries, privately, about whether living at Judy's is damaging for the kids, who've heard their share of muffled arguments already. He'd offered to move out of the house in Malting, but Annetta said she needed to look after her mother, and anyway she didn't like the thought of William in some shitty flat. She thought it would depress him. It depressed her just thinking about it. William didn't tell her that there was a different kind of depression in his living alone in their family home. Coming out of the house on a sunny weekend to see all the other families along the road doing their family things. Two boys on bicycles riding up and down the road, chased by a small girl on rollerblades. A woman watering a lavender bush. Grass flying behind a man pushing a mower back and forth. People actually washing their cars on a Sunday. William never lingers for long outside his house. He doesn't want to be noticed, to have to answer any questions, asked or not asked. And, less rationally, he's wary that something about him could start to bother the functioning, unbroken families around him. Not consciously, but in the way that birds suddenly unite to drive off one that's sick or injured. He doesn't think they'd turn up at his doorstep with makeshift clubs or anything, not in the suburbs. But they could start a petition. He told his friend Matt this, and Matt laughed. Divorce is contagious, Matt said. One of my colleagues got divorced, then three others followed within a year. I'm not divorced, said William. Oh yeah, right, sorry. William had also suggested to Annetta, early on, that the kids live with him. He could take them to school. His job was more flexible than hers in that respect. They like the bus, Annetta said. Their friends take the bus. But look, William, it's not just that. I don't want to be the one to point this out, but what about your bad days? The zoning out, the amount you drink, your sleep thing. He considered telling her that the last two had never been separate, concurrent problems, but one problem, night terrors, that was then replaced by another problem, drinking in the evening, which actually was replaced in turn by another problem that she wasn't even aware of, benzos. So technically just one problem overall. He'd started drinking a couple of whiskies before bed on the basis that it was preferable to the thrashing. The shouting, the accidental hitting of Annetta during the night. That had happened a few months before she moved out, William waking up in the final notes of his own shouted, "No!" The blood welling slowly through her fingers. "What did you dream about?" she'd asked in the morning. There was a bruise on the bridge of her nose. "I can't remember," he'd said. A lie. Then later, after Annetta left, it turned out that benzodiazepines did a better job than whiskey of stifling his dreams and made it easier to get up in the morning with plenty of time to take the kids to school. But then there were still the bad days and the zoning out. He sighed. She looked softer. He could tell she understood he'd given up. "I'm sorry," she said. "I know you miss them." Everyone says they know how much William misses them. He isn't sure they do know. Milo looks up now, an ice cream squiggle dried onto one hot cheek.
"I miss home," he says. "When can we come back?"
"Ah," says William. He can only repeat the line he and Annetta have agreed on, that Annetta needs to help Judy, and it's not forever. As expected, it fools Milo, but not Fiona, who says,
"But how long for? Until she dies?"
"No, until we come up with another plan."
"Ugh, that's a lie," says Fiona. "Granny told Mum she didn't need her and she should go home. You're both lying. Granny knows it and we know it. You and Mum are getting a divorce and you think we're stupid and we won't realise."
She stares at him. William can't think of anything to say. Long seconds pass. The sunlight turns sticky. A sugar hangover. A curdling. It dawns on him that Fiona didn't actually believe this, that she was asking him, not telling him. The realization comes along a few seconds after her eyes fill with tears. Late again. "I thought the police weren't even allowed to get memory wipes," Annetta says to William.
"They aren't allowed to wipe crimes," William says. "Or cases they've personally worked on, or if they were the subject of an investigation. But this memory doesn't fall into any of those categories, so all I need is sign-off."
Annetta shakes her head.
"What are your thoughts, Annetta?"
Marion Dunlop asks her.
"My thoughts are that this is crazy," Annetta says. "Sorry, but we came to you to talk. As an alternative to William destroying his brain cells. Can't we do that?"
"It's my professional responsibility to talk, neutrally, about all the options available to you," says Marion Dunlop.
"The procedure doesn't destroy anything anyway," William says. "The booklet says it's a chemical blocker. Every time you remember something, the memory has to be physically rebuilt. The brain has to make new proteins. It's called reconsolidation. So the drug blocks the formation of the proteins and the memory goes."
"Right," Annetta says. "Can I just point out that you seem to have a lot more to say on the neurochemistry or whatever of Nepenthe than you do about our marriage?"
"I was just trying to explain what was in the booklet."
"I read the booklet too," Annetta says. "But I still don't know what a chemical blocker does to someone's brain, what the side effects are. This procedure has only been around for 20 years. How can they know everything about it?"
"They can't," says Marion Dunlop.
"See,"
Annetta says to William.
"That's neutral advice. And isn't there the risk, Marion, that it can make people feel worse?"
"That's very rare for the people who know they had the procedure," says Marion Dunlop. "According to research, the vast majority seem happy with the knowledge that something happened, but not the detail. Though recent studies have shown that the concept of memory loss can be very troubling and destabilizing to some people."
"Identity..."
"I'm not troubled or destabilized or struggling," William says. "And I don't care about identity. I just want to get on with my life. If one of my fingers was infected and was poisoning my blood, I'd amputate it. It's simple.
But it's not simple, says Annetta. Didn't you say you thought it was weird that this particular case triggered PTSD? Because there was nothing very unusual or horrible about it. And you said that there were things about the memory, things that didn't even happen.
Little things, William says quickly. He feels pained by Annetta's obvious distress, but at the same time he wishes she'd stop talking. So I have communicated some things after all, he wants to say, and look what happens.
He turns to Marion Dunlop and says, It's not much, just small details, like I remembered her face differently. I thought she was holding something different.
This is the photo of the girl who died, is that right?
Marion Dunlop says.
The picture that triggered the PTSD response.
He nods.
But it's so specific, Annetta says. He said he remembered she was holding these sweets, the sour jellied ones, sour mix, and there were no sweets in the photo. So why would you remember something so specific?
Witnesses get details wrong all the time, William says. The longer it's been, the more wrong they are. I must have got confused at some point, included the sweets.
But saying this is a mistake. The word sweets connects up to the picture of sweets. A bag of them scattered through the broad puddle of blood on the ground. He can see the sugar on them, sparkling like real crystals. The shadow is coming. He can feel it at the edge of his awareness. He focuses on the room, stares at the box of tissues standing in front of the open window. He holds on to the sound of Marion Dunlop's voice like it's a rope hoisting him out of a well.
Well, what you're describing isn't that unusual, Marion Dunlop says to Annetta. Nobody really remembers events accurately. Even in a wider sense, we tell a story of ourselves and edit our memories so they fit that narrative. If the story we decide to tell changes, the memories change. We see memory as creating the self, but the self that's created looks back and changes the memory.
So that's it, Annetta says. It's settled. William's just going to go to Nepenthe and get a wipe, and we won't ever talk about anything ever again.
This upsets you, Marion Dunlop says.
Of course it does, cries Annetta.
Okay, how about we talk about talking, says Marion Dunlop.
She asks Annetta if she would say it's true that William was never much of a talker.
He never really spoke about his feelings, Annetta says. But he was always so kind and generous and a good listener, and he showed he cared, just in more non-verbal ways. And this was attractive to you.
Annetta blinks. She says, I don't see why this is suddenly about me.
William shares her concern. If Marion Dunlop cures Annetta of her attraction to William, what's going to happen then?
And it wasn't attractive, Annetta continues.
No, I liked to talk, but I made the best of it. I used to say to people, what would you rather? An imperfect man who could talk to you all day about his problems, or a perfect man who didn't talk at all. But then that wasn't the choice anymore, because then William did have problems and he wouldn't talk about them. He was more and more shut off. Cold, actually, if I pushed him. And I know he's suffering now, but it's like it's going on behind a closed door.
William was staring at a closed door when it first happened. It was 4 years ago, the morning meeting at work. Someone else had been assigned to the case, and William, for whatever reason, had been shown the photograph. William had excused himself and gone to the loos. He went into a cubicle, shut the door, put the lavatory seat down and sat on it. He stared at the advisory poster on the back of the door with a cartoon picture of E. coli being spread around the workplace. Now wash your hands, said the picture.
It was the first time he felt it, whatever it was. It was like he was at the bottom of the sea. It was cold there, inhumanly cold, and there was a great shadow passing over him, like the underside of an impossibly big ship. The ship moved over him, but it was so big that even when everything had gone black, there was still more to come. William held his breath. He couldn't surface. He had to wait for it to pass. Having the sense, even then, the first time, that if he could keep control of himself and just hold on, the shadow would, at some point, move on. The feeling was temporary. The feeling would lift. Just a matter of waiting it out. Who does that girl think she is? Annetta says, outside. They are standing by their cars, which are side by side in the small car park. It's a warm grey day. The aftermath of a summer rain rises humidly off the tarmac. For a moment, William thinks she means the girl. Then he realizes she's talking about Marion Dunlop. How do you mean? He says. How old is she anyway? 12? She mimics Marion Dunlop.
I know it's difficult for you, Annetta.
How can she know? She's not the one living with her bloody mother, dealing with questions from her children every bloody day. There are tears in her eyes. William wants to put his arm around her, maybe sneakily inhale her hair. One of the things that has come up in the sessions had been his inability to show spontaneous physical affection. Annetta said he didn't shrug her off exactly, but sometimes his look of surprise when she took his hand made her feel unnecessary, unasked for. Of course, now that he can't touch her, it's all he can think about. It's shit, he says. I'm sorry. It's just, how long has it been? A year? Living like this? Not knowing what's... I don't know. He puts his hand out, lightly touches her arm. She has her head bent, looking in her bag for a tissue. Then she looks up, suddenly, and he reflexively pulls back the hand. The touch was so tentative, the removal so fast, that he's not sure she even realized it happened. She wipes her eyes, blows her nose. I can't do it anymore, she says eventually. I can't. I'm scared about what will happen. But I'm not going to fight you. If this is what you're sure you need to do, go ahead. I'll support you. And I'll, I don't know, try my best to understand. William fills out the application form for a nepenthe consultation. While this is being processed, he needs to get senior management at his old unit to sign another form, confirming that the case in question had nothing to do with him, wasn't a crime, and so on. It should be simple, is what his GP says. After the procedure, you'll obviously know, very generally, what happened that morning, that you were shown this photograph, but you won't remember what was in the photograph or any of the details of the case. William feels uneasy. He prefers to do a thorough job. He'd like every element of the memory gone, nothing left behind. It couldn't be one of those self-confidential procedures, he asks. I'm afraid not. That's only for personal memories. This is professional, which means it has to be self-informed, and it'll go on your police record, by law. Yes, says William, because he already knew that. He's meant to get a call from Nepenthe within a week, inviting him to visit their clinic in Brighton to explain to a psychologist there what this particular memory has done to offend him. After that, he'll spend a mandatory 28 days thinking it over. Or choosing not to think about anything to do with it at all until the 28 days are over and he can go back to Nepenthe, sign the waiver, and pay the fee. £4,000, most of his savings, as Annetta could but would never remind him. Then he will go to the clinic and tell them about his problems and watch them disappear the moment they hit the air. The shadow will lift. Life will resume.